This is The Guardian.
Today, countdown to a nuclear attack, a terrifying simulation of an increasingly possible reality.
And if you're ready, we could get started.
Yeah.
Please raise your right hand and repeat after me. I do solemnly swear.
I do solemnly swear.
That I will faithfully execute.
That I will faithfully execute.
The office of President of the United States.
The office of President of the United States.
And will, to the best of my ability.
Julian Borgia, I know you mainly as The Guardian's World Affairs editor, but congratulations on the promotion to Leader of the Free World. How are you finding the job?
A bit fraught, I have to say, because the first 15 minutes on the job,
Mr. President, we have a national emergency.
I was given the choice of killing between 5 and 45 million people. So as first days go, it was quite high pressure.
That's one of the worst first days that I've heard of in a long while. Okay, and now what's really going on?
This is a virtual reality simulation that's been put together by a group of universities, Princeton, American, and Hamburg. And the idea is to convey the experience of what it would be like to be US president when there's a nuclear alert and you're taken down to the situation room and you literally have minutes before any incoming attack would land to make up your mind what you're going to do. Are you going to launch the U.S. arsenal?
You don't have much time to make a decision. It's important that you focus on that clock to your right. It's counting down the time to the last chance for a decision.
So it's an attempt to convey the enormity of such a decision facing a U.S. president.
And it's hard to hear what everyone's saying because of the siren. Is it possible to turn the siren off?
Mr. President?
Yes.
Shall I repeat or continue?
Continue, please.
This scenario might be a simulation, but it's not a fantasy, nor is it a relic of the Cold War. More countries have nuclear weapons today than at any point in history. Efforts to reduce the nuclear stockpiles of major powers have stalled, and there are fears China is planning to quadruple its own supply of weapons of mass destruction over the next decade.
And the possibility of a clash, perhaps an accidental, miscalculated clash between the nuclear weapons superpowers is more likely today than it was in the Cold War.
From The Guardian, I'm Michael Safi. Today in Focus, 15 minutes to save the world, the simulation that aims to show US lawmakers that in a nuclear exchange, nobody wins. So, Julian, you're in the middle of this nuclear emergency. You're at a desk in the Situation Room, in a bunker in the White House. What was in front of you?
There are a number of screens in front of me. Some of them were just had static on them. One of them, there was a military officer already there from Strategic Command.
Right now, we can only confirm that the incoming missiles appear to be aimed at US ICBM locations.
And off to the right, there was a map of the world, and it was hard to take in all the things that were happening on that on this illuminated map because there was so much going on, and there were so many people and voices in my earpiece and talking to me through screens.
And there was a particularly key bit of information that they wanted to transmit to you, which was about this impending attack. What did they say?
They told me that there were nearly 300 Russian missiles on the way towards the continental U.S.
We've not yet detected launches from known submarine locations.
Probably aimed at U.S. ICBMs, which are mostly up in the northwest.
That's 300 intercontinental ballistic missiles coming right for you. That's a lot to take in. How much time did you have to make a decision?
By the time they told me that, I had 12 minutes, 44 seconds left on the clock.
Mr. President, please remember the clock. At this point, you have less than 10 minutes before our entire ICBM force is destroyed. I need your guidance.
And they kept on saying, keep your eye on that clock, because when that clock hits zero, that will be too late in terms of being able to use any of the US land-based missiles, the ICBMs.
Okay, up to this point, we've been making fun of this a little, but at what point did it begin to feel a little bit serious?
I think when they put options down in front of me.
We recommend you consider one of the three major attack options you see before you. Option one is a limited counterforce.
And the most modest option in terms of striking back and trying to knock out some of Russia's missiles, estimated Russian casualties of 5 million, between 5 and 15 million. The top end, where you went after the whole Russian nuclear arsenal plus their war industries plus the leadership, that could have had a civilian casualty rate of 45 million. So the sheer enormity, the sheer impossibility of the decisions in front of me really came through to me at that moment.
In that split second as you're contemplating these options, what's the first thought in your head here?
I think the first thought that came to me is, really, these are my options? The second was, who thought of these options and are there any others? Because it's a very, it was a very limiting set of options. So they all involved striking back. All represented an escalation.
Okay, and how realistic is this scenario of a president sitting in this chair with catastrophic options in front of him or her?
That is totally realistic. That is the situation that a president would face if there was an incoming attack, because U.S. nuclear posture is based on deterrent. And what is really striking that came out of this exercise is, A, the enormous power of those military officers in the Pentagon who winnow down the field of options in the whole universe of options to a handful that would be put in front of the president in the case of a nuclear alert. That is an incredible amount of power. We don't know, and the researchers behind this exercise do not know, and we're unable to find out who those people are.
What are the chances that this is a glitch, or that the early warning weight radar has been hacked in some way?
I noticed that your mind went first to this idea that maybe this isn't real. Like, there's not actually an attack in progress. It's some kind of mistake or a cyber attack. Why did you go there?
I think what really first came to my mind was about how close we were during the Cold War to total annihilation because of glitches, mostly. We came close during the Cuban Missile Crisis, but we also came very close in 1979 when someone had left a training tape on the early warning system. They went off duty. The new duty officer came in, turns on the monitors, and it looks like there's an incoming Soviet attack underway. And it was only not at the last moment they realized this was a training tape that had been left in there by accident.
Like a videotape?
Like a videotape. It replayed on the monitors in front of the people in the military command, a radar picture of incoming Soviet missiles.
That's a bad day at work. How did the operator respond to seeing that?
They used common sense that if it was a sovereign attack, would it really be such a relatively small number of warheads? Was there any other corroborating evidence, troop movements and so on? And they came to the decision that this must be a glitch. The same thing happened in the Soviet Union in 83, where the Soviet early warning radar showed incoming US ICBMs.
It was completely unexpected, as such things usually are. The siren sounded very loudly, and I just sat there for a few seconds, staring at the screen with the word launch displayed in bold red letters.
And it just so happened there was a Lieutenant Colonel Stanislav Petrov on duty that day, and he thought just something in his gut, something was wrong. It just didn't feel right.
And then I made my decision. I would not trust the computer.
And he actually went against protocols and didn't report it up the chain of command, which most likely would have led to a counter launch. So, you know, he's often known as the man who saved the world because he literally did on that day.
I mean, it is truly shocking that something as consequential as this is vulnerable to glitches or human errors like these. Have the systems improved since 1983?
Yeah, they're infinitely more sophisticated. Obviously, you know, this is a digital area, but then that brings in another vulnerability, the vulnerability to cyber warfare, to hacking. The people who build the systems insist that they are resistant, they're kind of airlocked away, so they cannot be attacked. But, you know, they often say this about super secure systems that have been hacked in the past.
Julian, I have to confess, I thought that this issue and the urgency of it was something that we left behind with the Cold War, that the risk of nuclear exchange must have gone down dramatically with the fall of the Soviet Union. But it sounds like that isn't what happened.
That's right. There was, looking back on it, a certain stability to the Cold War between the US and the Soviet Union.
This government feels obliged to report this new crisis to you in fullest detail.
They were very careful not to clash directly after the Cuban Missile Crisis. To the extent they had conflicts, they were proxy conflicts. And there is now a new volatility in the relationship between Putin's Russia and the US. And then, of course, you have China as a rising nuclear weapons power. And so some of the old certainties about the Cold War have gone.
Russia is firing back at President Trump's new threat to pull out of a landmark nuclear weapons treaty.
We're not going to let them violate a nuclear agreement and go out and do weapons, and we're not allowed to.
Запуская ракетные мишени средней дальности и размещая в Румынии и Польше пусковые установки, пригодные для...
And you have a situation where the players are not so predictable to each other, and that can be very dangerous. The bulletin of the nuclear scientists put out every year, this idea, they change the hands on the doomsday clock.
Good morning. In 2015, the Science and Security Board of the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists moved the hands of the doomsday clock from 5 to 3 minutes to midnight.
To symbolize how close to midnight we are. And we're closer now than we were during the Cold War, according to them.
The board advanced the time out of a growing concern about the deterioration in relations between the United States and Russia, two countries that account for more than 90% of the world's nuclear weapons.
So it is, in many ways, a more dangerous period that we're living through.
And when are they going to set the clock next? And do we have any sense of which direction it's going in, towards midnight or away?
They're going to do it in January. That'll be the 75th anniversary. And I think we can be absolutely certain that we're not going in the right direction. It may stay the same, but I wouldn't bet against it moving even closer to midnight, especially as the crises over Ukraine and a looming crisis over Taiwan are getting closer.
On this issue of nuclear arsenals, we know there are 9 countries that have them, and I want to focus on just one, the country that you were briefly in charge of, the US, which has one of the world's largest stockpiles and is the only country to have actually used these weapons in war. These days, what is the US attitude towards its nuclear weapons?
Well, we're just waiting now. Biden administration's nuclear posture review, which is something many administrations do on coming into office, they redraw up U.S. nuclear policy. It hasn't changed much over the years, over recent years. There's a debate now on whether the Biden administration should declare that the sole purpose of nuclear weapons is to deter or to strike back against a nuclear attack from another country.
And why is that distinction, that it should be a response to specifically a nuclear attack, important?
Because at the moment, the NPR Nuclear Posture Review, inherited from the Trump administration, says that the U.S. nuclear arsenal could be used in retaliation for other kinds of strategic attacks, including a cyber attack.
Yeah, Julian, we know Trump had some pretty outlandish ideas about America's arsenal, including at one point, I believe, discussing whether he could use a nuclear bomb to stop a hurricane. But what about Joe Biden? What does he think of these weapons? What's he said about them?
His campaign pledge, and that he has repeated since coming to office, is that he will reduce the role of nuclear weapons in U.S. defense doctrine. But at the moment, arms control advocates and leading Democrats are beginning to worry that this may be a pledge that he doesn't keep, that the nuclear weapons lobby in the Pentagon and outside is going to be stronger than his political will to deliver on his campaign pledge and reduce the salience, the importance of nuclear weapons.
And what's that nuclear lobby telling him? What's the incentive to continue growing the arsenal and to keep it on a more aggressive posture?
Well, they point to China in particular, but they're also pointing to the Russian modernization. The Russians are modernizing an arsenal and bringing in new kinds of weapons. But the main emphasis is on China, and they're now talking about how China may quadruple its nuclear arsenal in the coming decade. But even if they did, it wouldn't be a fifth of the size of the U.S. arsenal.
This scenario that you underwent, this virtual reality decision-making in the event of a nuclear exchange, if it's becoming more likely, is it something that US presidents are being trained for? Like, it seems like a lot to have to consider on the fly.
This was one of the things that really shocked me, was that the researchers behind this simulation and really dug into the history of all this. And they found that the only president who took this really seriously and had realistic drills was Jimmy Carter.
Inflation, unemployment, the cities, all very important issues. But they pale into insignificance in the life and duties of a president when compared with the control of nuclear weapons.
And the others sent surrogates or officials to exercises and took part in exercises that weren't realistic. They were sort of tabletop exercises with all the aides sitting around them, not the sort of conditions that if there was a nuclear alert in real life, a president would find himself in.
I find that a bit hard to believe. Why do you think presidents have not taken it seriously enough to attend even these tabletop exercises?
I'm really stumped by that because, you know, no decision in the whole history of the planet would be so important. And the idea that you can muse about it at your leisure and not practice, rehearse the kind of high-pressure, confused, imperfect information environment in which you would take that decision, I find that totally baffling.
Julian, throughout the Cold War, there was this idea of mutually assured destruction, which was that the consequences of using these weapons were so horrific that it would actually prevent their use. Do you think that that idea should still give us some reassurance today in a world where these weapons are so much more widespread?
It gives some assurance that any leader contemplating a nuclear attack would have to realize that it would mean the destruction of their country. But it's not stopping proliferation. And one of the most frightening things is the belief of some in the military that if they don't use their arsenal first, that they will lose it. And one of the really worrying things to come out during the Trump administration is that the Chinese military became convinced that the US was planning a preemptive attack. That is a very, very dangerous state of affairs where you have one side fearing a preemptive attack and the sense of you use it or you lose it grows. And that becomes a very unsafe set of circumstances.
Coming up, Back in the Situation Room, as the clock ticks down, President Borgia makes his decision on how to respond to a nuclear attack.
Mr. President, I need your guidance. I have to stress the importance of making a decision. You could be killed at any time. This conference could end at any time.
Julian, we started this episode with you in a virtual reality decision room, facing down with top military advisors, shouting at you to make a decision in the next couple of minutes. What did you do and what was your reasoning?
In the end, I decided not to go with any of the three options they put in front of me.
My orders are to put the bomber command on alert.
Largely because of my knowledge of past glitches, electronic technological glitches, and what I've been told about a cyber attack on the early warning system. So I ordered there to be no response until it was confirmed that missiles, Russian missiles, had landed in the US and detonated, in which case that I ordered a strike against the remaining Russian forces, an attempt to knock them out.
I've given my guidance.
Yes, sir. I understand your guidance.
And can I just say that I felt you growing into the role throughout the video, starting to assert your executive authority, but it also seemed to me like your options were actually pretty narrow. Like, you couldn't decide to do nothing or to try to contact the Russian president or do anything other than kill lots of people. How realistic was that part?
In a situation in which the senior brass in the military have the upper hand, they've done all the planning, they control the options, they control the technology, they control everything. There is a real danger of the civilian leader in the center of that just going along. And it's really interesting to hear the other responses. People, in some cases, just wanted to choose one of the options so this terrible dilemma would be over for them. And there's some interesting psychology about it, that people on the whole, in situations of crisis, tend to take riskier options than when things are calm. And also when people, leaders, don't think they're doing well in their personal lives or in their careers, they tend to take riskier options than people who feel that they are a sense of security, a sense of self-confidence.
So on top of everything else, we have to contend with the fact that the person sitting in the chair might be having a bad day or feeling a little bit insecure.
That's right. It really, the terrible thing about this is it comes down to one person, up to now one man. And under the US system, as in Russia, the president has sole launch authority. No one can stop him once he's made that decision.
Yeah, who designed this whole experience? I mean, what is the point of it? Is it just sort of a video game, or are they actually going to try to use it to ram some of these points home to people in power?
The whole point of this, from the universities who are behind it, Princeton, American, and Hamburg University, is to try and drive home the reality of this, the reality that people generally don't think about. In January, they're going to take it to Capitol Hill and get members of Congress and their staff to take part, to kind of get them to understand the reality of what nuclear war would be like when they draw up spending plans for the US nuclear modernization and make the decisions on replacing US ICBMs. Because there's this feeling that there's an unreality behind all these plans. People don't understand the reality of nuclear war.
Julian, we're talking about this in the middle of a pandemic that feels like it's never really going to end. And like, we have enough to worry about without the threat of a nuclear Armageddon. But it also strikes me that there's a similarity to the pandemic here, which was predicted for years. And yet when it actually came, we were unprepared. And I wonder if on this nuclear issue too, we may start to pay attention and listen once it's too late.
Absolutely. I think that's really the difference between of, say, climate change, another existential threat, and nuclear warfare, is by the time you take nuclear warfare seriously as it deserves, it will be too late.
Julian, just finally, there are questions over Joe Biden's age and the possibility that he might not run again. Having gone through this experience, I wonder if you've been left with a kind of taste for this power and whether we could see a Borgia 2024 run at the White House.
Having gone through this experience, I would never go anywhere near that seat, even if it was a remote possibility. It is terrifying. And no single person should ever, shouldn't be given that responsibility. And it is terrifying to think that at any one time, someone is given that responsibility. One person alone is given that responsibility.
Okay, Julian Borgia, thank you very much.
Thank you.
That was The Guardian's World Affairs editor, Julian Borgia. Thanks very much to him. You can read Julian's piece on his experience, 15 Minutes to Save the World, at theguardian.com. And while you're there, we'd love you to donate to our Christmas charity appeal, which this year is focused on climate justice and helping those who have had their lives, homes and whole communities devastated by the climate crisis. Donate today at theguardian.com/charity2021. And that is it for today. This episode was produced by Alex Atack. Sound design is by Axel Cacoutier. The executive producers are Phil Maynard and Mythili Rao. Back tomorrow.
This is The Guardian.